Hi there, and welcome to another interview. And I'm going to start with a question that I ask every single guest. Neithi, why did you become carnivore?
Wow. Well, I like meat, first of all. But actually, the truth is that I have been trying to gain health for many years. I don't know that I was trying to gain health in the way a lot of other people were, because I ended up with a diagnosis of vitiligo when I was like 11 years old. And so I was very fortunate that I come from a family of doctors. My grandfather was a renowned homeopathic physician when he was living. And my mother is the baby of 10, and she was basically like our grandchild in his practice. And she used to ask him lots of questions and just kind of be there hanging out in the background and obviously observing things like children do. So she was one day, I was 11. We had a whole bunch of family over at the house. All of us were kind of like on the floor, on the sofas, whatever, you know, hanging out. If you can imagine, you know, when the family gets together and you're all talking, there's a bunch of people and you're kind of just got pillows and you're kind of laying around on the floor with each other or whatever. Then my mom was kind of playing with my hair, you know, while I was laying on the floor, and she noticed a spot on the back of my neck, like at the nape of my neck. And she kind of freaked out. And I was like all of a sudden, you know, she just was like digging all in the back of my neck going, "What is that?" And she's really trying to look at it. And I was like, "What's wrong with you?" You know? And then she started checking all over my face and all this stuff. And then she started like, she genuinely was kind of panicked because she had seen vitiligo and she was like, "Oh my God, this can't be it." And she was kind of looking. And then the next thing, you know, my mom, you know, we, like I said, we come from a family of doctors. So she starts calling all the people in the family. This is before internet, before this is, you know, just to put everybody, like, this is 1981. Okay. And so no cell phones, no anything. And all of our family was in India. It was still like, you know, I don't know if any of the people out there realize that we used to pay for long distance phone calls, and international calls were, sometimes you had to book them. Like, you couldn't just dial an international call. And so for her to actually have a proper conversation with our family in India, it was really no small feat, especially because India at that time was also like 10 years behind us. Everyone didn't have a phone. So in their house, and our family's like not in the villages, like they're pretty well to do, but like people in the big cities also, still everyone didn't have a phone or, you know, whatever. There was like one phone in the whole house or something like that. So it wasn't as if you could just get on the horn with somebody and just get answers right away. I just want to make it clearer how much work was involved in trying to communicate with people and how much time it took and whatever. So anyway, she just starts doing all of that. And I would say probably it took about 3 to 6 months. I don't know. I was 11, you know, like it took a long time for her to finally get to the point where she had established that there were only two physicians in the States that we could be referred to. This is being referred to them from our family physicians in India. Okay. So they got us the connection and said, there's these two people in the States that understand and know how to cure vitiligo right now. One's in LA and one's in Atlanta. Well, I was growing up in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's on the East Coast. LA was out. That was like not an option for us. So she started hammering to try to get in touch with the physician who was in Atlanta, Georgia. Well, she found out that we couldn't get an appointment with this physician for 6 months to a year, if ever. And she was finally like, God, you know, she finally decided to stop trying to make an appointment. And she just started calling the office, trying to talk to the physician. And then they told her that she couldn't talk to him. He didn't have time. He couldn't call her back. Ding, ding, dong. Like, they kept going back and forth. And my mom was like, "Who is this guy? Like, is he God? Like, what's happening?" And she said that to them. After which, within 20 minutes, she got a phone call from the physician. And he was just like, you know, she says, I don't know who you are or what the thing is, but do you know anything about vitiligo? Do you know anything about vitiligo? And he says, not only do I know about vitiligo, I can cure vitiligo. And just to like let all the listeners know, you know, all your people who are following this conversation, I did not know this really, but just the other day I was listening to a conversation between these quantum biologists, and I just heard them say that even today in 2023, there's no medical mafia member who believes that there is a cure for vitiligo. So I am just here to reveal to you and all of your listeners that I am 100% cured. And there is a cure for vitiligo, and it is all based in light therapy. So that is where I'm coming from. And the reason this is an important story is because the therapy that I went through was from age 11 until age 19. And during those years, I remember we used to go through a lot to go to these appointments in Atlanta because we lived in Charlotte. It's a 4-hour drive. And this was an intense therapy. Everybody wasn't able to give us this therapy. Someone needed to have this PUVA box, this UVA, UVB box, to be able to offer the therapy. And they had to know how to use this box. Moreover, the physician who I was going to see, he compounded his own pharmaceuticals I'm calling it pharmaceuticals. They could have been nutraceuticals. I don't actually really know. And unfortunately, my doctor died. He died in 2007. And so I have been wanting to talk to him and wanting to know things from him. And I've had no way to get in touch with him. And I just recently found out that he died in 2007. And that's why I haven't been able to find him. And so I'm kind of really heartbroken about that, because when we did have access to him, I was a kid. And as I was going through my 20s, you know, I mean, I didn't appreciate all of that I had gone through, you know, at that time. But I was finding out that I was just having problems with digestion. I was having, you know, I mean, I literally kept having these chronic bronchial attacks, and, you know, they just kept putting me on antibiotic after antibiotic. And I just knew that wasn't right. And then obviously, if you're taking antibiotics all the time, then you end up with UTIs and 1,000 other problems. And I was just like, what is happening? I at one time, I remember feeling like, I think I'm dying. Like, I just think I'm dying. I don't know what's going on. And so I wrote a letter to my grandfather, the renowned homeopathic physician. You know, I wrote to him and I was like, I don't know what is happening. I think I'm dying. You know, and I explained to him, like, what is happening? And he wrote back. And of course, this took weeks for me to get a response from him, obviously, because we're on the other side of the world. There's still no phone connection. That's so easy. Nobody was just like, oh, let's just call internationally, you know. And if I were to call him, he would be upset. He would be worried. He would think that something was really wrong. It wasn't like you could just call and have a casual conversation. I mean, I guess somebody could, but like, we just didn't. So, you know, anyway, I got his letter and he said, you know, I want you to stop eating dairy for 2 years and just see what happens. And I thought, that's weird. And especially because I loved dairy, you know, I mean, also just for the record, I've always cooked. I love to cook. I always cooked everything from scratch. I wasn't buying pre-made meals. I've never eaten food out of a can. I mean, I have never eaten food out of a can. I remember when I first went to college and my roommate was eating some Chef Boyardee or something. And she said, you don't want to eat this? And I was like, I don't even know what that is. And so she was like, you should try it. And I tried like a bite of it. And I thought, this is disgusting, because I knew how to cook, you know, and if you know how to cook, then anything out of a can tastes like garbage. So I couldn't understand how people eat this stuff. So, you know, I think a lot of other people have been always trying to do like a lot of food hacks, a lot of these kind of things. I've never done that because my grandfather was a homeopathic physician. I knew that food is medicine. We had to be really careful and that you can't just mess around with food. And being Indian, And coming from this background that was like the most plant-based background ever, I didn't need to try to be vegetarian or anything. We were mostly vegetarian, although in our family, we ate meat. But, you know, the more I've gone down this road, I realized how anybody in the orthodoxy who believes that they eat a lot of meat, they don't. And anybody who ate a little bit of meat really barely did. And so we barely did, you know, but we did cook and do everything from absolute scratch. I still had to figure this whole thing out though, right? And so I let the dairy go for a couple of years, which for me, all that meant was I'm not eating like pizzas, which I really didn't anyway, unless we made them, which I wasn't gonna because who wants to do that? And also for the young people, we didn't have pizza delivery. I mean, I wasn't used to pizza delivery because growing up, we never had pizza delivery. Like you had to go to a pizza restaurant, which also I remember when those started, I was probably 13 or something when there were actually Pizza Huts or something like that. Like there was no Pizza Hut and definitely there was no Domino's or anything like that. And all of that stuff came about, I think, closer to my 20s or later. And you know, if it's not in your habits from being young, you don't really think about that as something, as a solution, you know? So for me, it was just whatever I would cook in my kitchen. So the only time I would eat pizza is if I went out with friends or if I was somewhere and they ordered it. Otherwise I would have not had it. And since I couldn't have dairy, now I didn't eat pizza, which effectively cut out all the wheat and all the stuff that went along with it, which actually was just kind of a bonus. And because I was cooking a lot of Indian food and I love to cook, I used to also cook a lot of like French Creole food. I used to cook a lot of Southern food. I used to cook a lot of, and I actually worked for these Italians in my 20s. And I mean, I could tell you that I used to win contests for making like the most incredible gravies and you know, things of that nature. So I would say if anything, I still had pasta in my life and I had a couple pieces of toast in the morning or whatever, which I think everybody did that sort of thing, you know, but I wasn't a big sandwich eater because I cooked. I used to want a hot lunch. I used to want something warm. So I used to have a lot of, meat, vegetables and rice. And that's very Creole. It's also very New Orleans. It's also very Southern and it's also very Indian. So that was kind of how that went. And I'm moving along. I'm not having as many bronchial issues. The cutting the dairy out really helped. So I knew that if I had dairy more than once in a week, I would definitely be really sick. I was able to tolerate it once a month or once every other month or something like that. And so, but I cut out all the milk. I cut out all the stuff just because of this reason. I did not cut butter out and I never counted it as dairy because I've always cooked in ghee. I've always made my own ghee. We always grew up with ghee because it was an Indian household. I never cooked with oils because I can make ghee and everything tastes better in ghee. So I just always used that. And I think that was probably what kind of saved me, like, or kept my health up, you know, even though what I was eating was sugar on sugar on sugar on sugar with all the plant material. Now you can fast forward. I get married. We have kids. I don't meet my husband until I'm 30, you know, so we're a lot older. And all of our friends were having a lot of trouble conceiving. So we thought we were going to have trouble, but we didn't. And it was like, oh, surprise, but you're pregnant. And so we had one baby. Then within 13 months, we had another baby. And then within 13 months, we found out the second baby, she had cancer. So that's when I'm like, whoa, what is happening? And I turn on all of my training from my homeopathic grandfather, like, you know, what's in our food, what's in our environment, what's going on, what's happening, you know, why is this happening? And I'm trying to just figure these things out. And I walk into Duke Children's Hospital where they say, this has absolutely nothing to do with your food or your environment. And I'm like, okay, this is nonsense. And I didn't know that because I have a whole world of doctors that, and I also know that you're just people, you're somebody's brother, father, whatever. And, you know, you don't know, you're not the knower of all things either. So, also no Google at that time. This is 2007. It's not like I can like Google something up or whatever. So I'm actually looking at literature. I'm reading, I'm researching old school style because I don't know any other way to research, you know? And I'm like, people say to me now, Stephen, they're just like, well, how did you know this? And how did you know that? And ding, ding, dong. And they're like, send me your information that you, where did you find such and such? Guys, I don't know where I found that stuff. I was reading, I have read so much material. I have no idea even how to send you my palette of books and articles. And because some of it was just articles, you know, like it was just, I was in the hospital. I was researching everything I could find everywhere. And I was reading like medical journals and stuff. And this was not anything on the internet because I didn't have access to, I mean, I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a smartphone. Like, and for anybody out there, you know, I think iPhones only came out in 2008 or something. I think, I know YouTube didn't start until later. Facebook didn't start until 2008. I mean, we did not have technology, folks. And it was 2007. I was a stay-at-home mom. And I didn't have, I mean, the only way that I know people had all these computers and things was because of their jobs. Like their company would give them a laptop or whatever. And I mean, we had a computer at home. I knew how to use one. I also used to work. So, I mean, you know, when we had children, we were so much older. I mean, I had a whole profession in my past life, you know, and so, I mean, I'm a professional. I know how to do things. I know how to, but I also, you know how to read and research. So anyway, this led me to want to try to just really figure out where I'm getting my food, because the long and the short of it was that I was like, I don't really trust where things are coming from. And I don't know what's in a store. And not because somebody told me, not because I read this. I was literally like, I don't know where this is coming from. So the only way for me to figure it out is for me to just find the food. And it was the only thing that really made sense to me. I was just kind of led to it like naturally. And I started looking for food and I started talking to farmers and they were acting really weird. And especially when I would tell them that my daughter had cancer and, you know, that she's in the hospital and we're trying to figure all these things out. And the more that I got involved in our agricultural community locally, the more I learned that our farmers were being literally treated like slaves. They were part of this corporatocracy. Nobody was producing really clean food, meaning without chemicals being sprayed all over everything, because there was no money for them to make because nobody cared what they ate. What? This is where I was. I was like, are you freaking kidding me right now? So I'm cooking from scratch from the grocery store, but even at the farmers markets, even locally, even everywhere, nobody was raising any because everybody was like, all the farmers were like, well, everybody wants it to be cheap and fast and easy. And we can't produce it for cheap unless we do ding, ding, dong, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all these wrong things. And I thought, this is the problem. This is the problem. So I said, do you know anybody who is growing anything or raising any food without all of this stuff? And I met this lady and she said, hey, can I tell you something? And I was like, yeah. She goes, can you call me? Will you call me at home? Because I'm at a market, okay? And I was like, sure. Because she heard me going around talking to everybody and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And she was like, this lady won't leave. Like she realized, you know, like I got her attention. And so I went home and called her and she said, I was wondering, my husband and I were wondering if you would want to come out here and visit. And I thought, okay, I don't know what I'm walking into, you know? So, but I mean, why is she doing this? I go to her their place and they said, listen, we can't talk about these things at a farmer's market because that's a centralized distribution location that is run under health code. She goes, do you know what the codes are? And I'm like, what? She said, the health codes from the USDA and the FDA run all the food and we have to follow the rules if we want to go to market. What are you talking about? And she goes, so let me just tell you, if we raise produce, then for us to sell it at market, we have to wash it in bleach before we can take it there. Did you know that? I'm looking at her like, Clorox? What are you talking about? She said, yes, yes, ma'am. It is required. It is mandatory for us to wash the produce in a chlorine wash if we want to bring it to market. Stephen, I was ready to throw up. And that was just the first thing. So this went on and on and on. And she and I are very good friends even today. Found out her birthday is the day before mine. And we just have really clicked all these years. But she opened my eyes. She said, nobody can have these conversations at a farmer's market. No one can tell you what they're really doing or not doing for fear of, you know, because they can't sell it. So when we're at home, she says, we just rinse our food off out in the yard and then we bring it in and we just eat it. We don't spray our stuff, but we can't call it organic or anything, which back then, I don't even think organic was a word. I don't think that was the word in, you know, at that time, you know, because since then you have all natural, ding dong, blah, blah, organic. GMO free. And at that time, nobody was even talking about GMOs. You know, the genetic roulette, Jeffrey Smith's book had not even come out until 2009. So this is way before all of that, way like Whole 30, when Dallas Austin and Melissa Hartwig wrote that, they were just writing it in 2009. So this is well before all of that. This is before anybody was calling anything paleo. Like this wasn't nothing. There was no paleo diet at the time. So I started to get to know her family and all her neighbors and all these other farmers, and then found out also we don't have any meat at the market because I kept saying, well, what do I do about meat? Because I don't want to buy that in a grocery store. And then that took me down a whole nother rabbit hole of what do they do to our meat? How absolutely disgusting that is. And why these people, they have their radically self-reliant small communities out in the country and they're all supporting each other. And everybody in town is being poisoned with the fluoride in the water, the chlorine. They have spent 2 years studying water. I mean, I can't tell you. All that did was open up all the things for me to now, you know, I mean, and of course, I was already aware of lights because of my vitiligo. I was aware of light therapy. I was aware of circadian rhythm. I was also like, you know, well, our food has light, like it's grown with light. So, you know, food is light. This is me back then, way back when I was saying this. And I kept saying, if you don't know where your food came from and you don't know who raised it, if the animals that you're eating aren't healthier than you are, then they can't give you any health. Because now I'm looking at the animals that are in these confined animal feeding operations. And then, by the way, in here in Raleigh, in North Carolina, we have the largest CAFOs in the world here. All of Smithfield, which is pork, which is, by the way, owned by China, is here in Smithfield, North Carolina, which is like 40 minutes from my house. Okay. And that's what I'm realizing. Oh my God. All of Eastern North Carolina that used to be, because we were an agricultural state. We're still an agricultural state, but we're a CAFO state, actually, is what it is. Because all of Eastern North Carolina was bought by China and is being used to produce confined animal feeding operations. And NC State is the centralized university that's teaching it. So anybody who is learning about how to manage agriculture from a university is only learning centralized, you know, I call it, you know, chemistry project food. They don't know how to raise anything that is honoring our life-giving force. Nothing. And I've been saying that since 15 years ago when I went to meet these farmers and I started to get to know everybody. And of course, now there have been levels of language. Of course, there's the linguistic stuff and they keep changing all the words and people keep buying all these words. So that was another thing that people don't know out there. Eaters out there don't know that to say that something is organic, to say that something is whatever, requires the producer to pay the de facto government, which is not even a de jure government. It is the corporatocracy. They have to pay the corporatocracy a toll, a fine, a fee, an illegal tax, whatever you want to call it, to use this word. So if you go to a farmer's market and you're like, hey, are you organic? They're going to be like, no, bye, because they can't afford to do that. So this is the other problem. Eaters think that if you go directly to a farmer, it's going to be cheaper than in the grocery store, because it should be. Because if you go to the source instead of, you know, you cut out all these third parties, then it should be cheaper. Why isn't it cheaper? It's not cheaper because it's not real. So only the corporatocracy's machine can produce this fake and phony lie. And there is no human being who can even participate in all of that because it's immoral. And for an institution to behave immorally, well, this is defined morality. What is morality? Morality is when your thoughts and your emotions and your actions all align. And it forms a triangle. This is the masculine symbol for action. It's the blade. And it is a natural law. It is impossible for us, because we're liquid love, right? It is impossible for us to operate in that much evil directly. Now, a corporation is operating under standard operating procedures. They're doing whatever, like a machine at scale. No one individual person is responsible for anything. And no one individual person is watching anything happen from beginning to end. And they have no relationship with the eater or the end user, as they refer to us, you know, living beings, the end user. I'm not an end user and I'm not a consumer. I'm an eater, which is an agrarian act, which is a human act of, you know, becoming one with the land and soil. So, you know, if you are an eater, if you are a human being who is interested in becoming one with the land and soil, then you also should not participate in the corporatocracy, which is creating some kind of chemistry project, imitation, food-like substance, and holding you prisoner and hostage, and is 100% responsible for your needless suffering that you could just stop anytime by just not ever going there. So I wrote a book about my story. This is my book. It's called Farm to Fork Meat Riot. And then it says, regenerating life-giving force. And the most important is the hashtag, get out of the grocery store. And I think people, all the human beings out there that are interested in connecting with the land and soil, you need to know, because if you're in cities, most people have never experienced this. And if you operate with health insurance, then you have never experienced the grace of nature. And I have a whole chapter in here about how nature has grace. And, you know, I also talk about, look, the first third of my book is our personal story. And it talks about what happened with our daughter. And the second third of the book is about what I did with that information, which, you know, I chose to operate in clarity through contrast. Okay. I chose to operate in clarity and not in chaos and confusion anymore. I made a decision that the corporatocracy wants to hold us in chaos and confusion at all times, so that they can maneuver this power differential. You know, a lot of people might be like, what are you talking about? Who's trying to control it? You know, like, I'm not here to have a discussion about who and why, but I will tell you that there are a few people who have a knowledge differential, which they hold over everybody else as a power differential. And if you're one of those people that believes that, you know, sometimes you just can't do anything except whatever because you just have no choice, then you just don't understand your full power. And it is my desire and it is my intention to try to pour knowledge over as many of you as I can reach to let you know that you are important and that you matter and that you were born worthy beyond belief and that you are giving your power away. You are giving it away because somebody has convinced you that you need them. And I was that same foolish somebody who gave all my power to the medical mafia because I thought that I needed them to save my daughter. And let me just tell you something. No, the answer is a whopping no. I don't need anybody to tell me how to do anything. And if I would have taken responsibility, which I tried to do as soon as I realized, you know, if I would have taken responsibility from the beginning to control what was going into our mouths, you know, I mean, and I'll tell you what, my children are now 15, my surviving children, we lost Nina, but my surviving children are 15 and 19. And they probably, I mean, they can't stand that I'm so militant about it, you know, because I mean, I am militant. I will not eat food if I don't know where it came from. And I drive that into them and I impose that upon them all the time because it is my work. It is my job as their mother to make sure that they have knowledge. And I will not allow anybody to ever make me believe for even a minute that it is not my work to polish them to know the truth. And I'm always going to polish them with the truth. And then if they want to go out there and operate in lies, they're going to know immediately. They should know immediately. Oh, you know, if they don't know, I mean, it's impossible. They will know. They'll figure it out. But yeah, I mean, are they going to touch the fire and get burnt? I'm sure they are because they should. Like, you know, you should not operate in fear. And I didn't raise them to operate in fear. I raised them to live dangerously. You know, if they're not living dangerously, then, you know, what did I do? What did I do? Like, they're not formidable if I haven't made them dangerous. So I need them to be dangerously living, and I haven't bubble wrapped them or anything like that. But I definitely pour knowledge over them at all times because, you know, I need them to know the truth.
Yeah, I mean, knowledge is power, isn't it? And that's the thing. I mean, there was a lot there. That's a great answer, by the way. And I know you went into an area that you're very passionate about. I mean, one of the things that is a big thing in my life is I'm always talking about objective truth. And this started with diabetes, for instance, when people say, well, you know, complex carbohydrates are different to normal simple carbohydrates. And I say, well, the objective truth can be discovered by just using your glucose meter. And you can tell whether you've been lied to or not. And then your story there, where you had a non-curable disease, which you cured. You see, now that's an objective truth that happened, you know, and even when you tell people, the mainstream pushes back and says, no, that's not true. That must be something else. It can't be that, you know, and that's what I mean about knowledge, you see, because I think when you're a carnivore, for instance, you know, it's analogous what you're saying, you know, because carnivore reverses diseases that is allegedly an irreversible condition. You had a condition that's not curable. So when you start to see that you're being, and I will be strong because you got a strong opinion, when you're being flat out lied to about stuff, you have to go and do that research. And I think one of the things that worked in your favor was you didn't have Google to even try it. You had to go to books where there's proper knowledge and proper research rather than, and this was a big revelation for me, to be honest. I did realize this quite early on that Google doesn't give you results. It gives you what it wants to give you, you know, and that's the thing. And, you know, even apps I used to like something simple, but it's the same principle, like TripAdvisor. Used to be quite good, and now it's just telling you what the sponsors want to tell you and what, you know, where to go. So that was a brilliant answer. I'm assuming, you know, it was quite a cheeky, quick answer when you said, when I asked why you went carnivore, I said, well, I like meat. But I think it's more to do with the fact that as you researched, you found out there was lots of things that were causing you problems. I just want to pick up on one thing you said, which I really liked, because you had to give up dairy. Well, there's two questions to this. I don't normally ask two-part questions. But you said a beautiful thing when you said, well, because I gave up dairy, I gave up pizza. But by accident, you give up wheat and you give up flour and all that sort of stuff. You also talk about raw dairy. You know, I've looked at your Facebook. And do you have any views about the difference between raw dairy and pasteurized dairy, for instance?
I do. I think that there's living food and life-giving force, and then there's dead chemistry project, you know, fake. And the thing that's tricky about this that people aren't unaware of is that there's dirty raw dairy, which is wrong animals, meaning incorrect. So what people don't understand is that there's been a whole lot of hybridization of genetics in livestock to promote volume production. And so, for example, the black and white spotted cow that everybody like associates with dairy is a Holstein. And Holsteins are not the genetic they don't have the genetic predisposition to produce the milk that actually would benefit humans. Can we drink it? Yes, we can. Is it optimal for us? Probably not most of us. Is it better than plants? Yes, it is 100%. So, you know, the thing that I like everybody to know is that dairy is the carbs for carnivores. Do we require dairy? No, we do not. If as a producer, I'm not currently in production of the food, but I work with people who are producing the food, and I have people who are producing the food to meet our criteria. Because in this book, I also have a livestock report card, and I am teaching eaters what to look for in knowing what kind of livestock you should be seeking, how the livestock should be managed for it to produce, you know, meat that's going to offer you the most optimal life-giving force, or dairy, you know, for that matter. How should each of the animals be managed? So I've done that too in here, just so you know. But because I'm working with producers, then, you know, like if I could just have my own creamery, if I could have infrastructure to do all the production, then I would only cream all the milk so that we ended up with whey, and use all the cream to make butter, and then use the butter to have as our food, and also, you know, to make ghee. And I would use all the whey to soak and sprout feed for the omnivores that we have on the farm, and, you know, or just to directly feed, because all of our hogs and chickens require that extra protein. They need that. And so that would be the supplement to help. I mean, I also work with a lot of regenerative farmers and homesteaders if they're interested in learning how to have feed freedom. And, you know, because really, if we want to be successful, you know, we need to learn how to exit the centralized paradigm and you know, participate in the decentralized paradigm. And I think it's interesting because now, after 15 years of running this parallel system, I created this food church here in Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a counter-economic parallel structure to the centralized food system. And what I've learned you know, is, you know, how I know what I can do to scale. What people don't know is that you've never paid for your food ever in this centralized system. All you're doing, unless you're paying a farmer directly, you are paying for distribution and storage. And if you're paying a farmer directly, at least in America, most of them don't know their inputs. And so they're not even making the right amount of money because they're feeling as though they're competing with the centralized imitation food system because of the pressure from consumers. And that's why I say I will not work with consumers. I'll only work with eaters. If you're not a human being, I'm not interested in dealing with you. If you want to be a dehumanized, centralized robot, then you should 100% go to the grocery store and, you know, deal with whatever that chaos is. But if you want to live and not die because you're a loving, liquid, love human being, then you really need to come back to the land and soil, if nothing else, in your mind, so you can understand how to support regenerative agriculture. So that's the other thing that's funny. Like when I found out that Sean Baker was doing his carnivore thing, I had already been promoting regenerative meat. I had already been promoting that you have to eat within your light cycle. I had already been saying, like, we're in North Carolina. Why would you eat coconuts? You're going to die. That's going to make you die. It's a circadian mismatch. Where are the coconuts? They're nowhere. They're not here. I don't even have bananas. I don't have fruit most of the year. There's no fruit here, you know, like, because it's not a tropical location. So we only really have fruit for about the summer. I mean, for 3 months out of the year, you know, is when you really have fruit. And anything else outside of that 3 month span is in a greenhouse, it's being manipulated, it's going to be a circadian mismatch. Your body isn't going to understand the code that's coming in. I think people don't know that when you put a bite of food in your mouth, then it is delivering information. It is an information pack that you're putting into your mouth. It is light energy. And you're coding your DNA with every bite. You're actually coding your DNA with every thought, which is the reason why you have to be very careful to, you know, clean your thoughts up and really keep them in a high consciousness. So I've been doing a lot of talking recently, Stephen, instead of talking so much about meat, because I found myself on this weird carnivore tripping wheel where I was never really aligning 100% with only the people that talk about the meat or only the people talk about the ding and the dong and the whatever, you know, because there's so many parts and pieces to it. So I've always considered myself a regenerative health coach because I'm looking at, when I'm coaching people, I'm not just looking at one thing. It's not just that you have to eat meat. You have to, you know, be conscious of your thoughts. You have to be conscious of your lighting. You have to be conscious of the timing of what you're doing. You have to, you know, manage, you have to have, you know, a bedtime routine. You have to love yourself. You need to know that you should love yourself first, you know, before even caring. Like, the meat doesn't matter if you don't love yourself, you know. And most people right now, I think, have a very hard time loving themselves because they've just been diminished for so long. So the first thing I try to do is I just ask people, I'm like, are you okay? Like, you know, do you love yourself yet? You know, yeah. A lot of people, you know, before you can even coach them, I'm like, well, do you love yourself enough to know that you're worth the coaching that we're going to do? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people have to realize that they've got to be like who they are. I mean, that helps. And there's different ways of looking at it. I mean, obviously people worried about how they look, what color their hair is and all those sort of things, all the sort of trivia things. I just want to echo something that you said, because when I joined MeatRx and we first met and I was getting into carnivore, I think I'm quite an aware person, but I at the time remember thinking, wow, Sean's talking a lot about this regenerative farming. You know, I'm only here for the food, really. And I really, I've said this publicly a few times. I've even said it to him actually when he interviewed me, but I then realized actually there is more to it, and it is political, and it is important, because if you want your health back, then you have to be open to what's going on and how your food is being produced. Exactly what you're saying. I mean, I loved the fact that you were passionate back then when we started, and you still are. And I think you're right. There'll be some people that have not even got to the end of this, which is a shame. And some people have got to the end of this podcast and thought, well, you know, that's a lot about regenerative farming. I just want to know about what to eat, and you know, is it OMAD and all this sort of stuff. But I promise you, the more you do carnivore, the more you realize that actually, when you get into the nuance, when you get into where's your food coming from, why is this steak particularly good, and why is this feedlot not particularly good to be buying from, all of those things become really important. I'm ever so lucky because I do buy direct from the farmer. I am very lucky to do that, and I know that. But I would say to people, I had to find those farmers. You know, I didn't just go onto Google and say, can you give me a farmer that I can buy from? You have to be out there and being active. And I'm really, really sorry if it sort of seems too difficult to get away from the grocery store. But if you can, you will feel better. And not only that, people will say, well, it's so cheap to go to the grocery store. Well, actually, in the long run, is it? Because you will possibly pay for your health, which is very expensive. And also, if you're eating really good source food, you tend to feel fuller quicker. You tend to feel satiated. You tend to eat less junk and all the stuff that goes around food, you tend to buy less of. So it's a really good message. It's very unusual for me to wrap up because I normally do very short interviews, but that was just so good. I just had to let you speak there. And I think I might have to get you back because I've got tons of questions, really. But I am wrapping up. So is there any sort of final thoughts you want to give me?
I just think that, you know, hearing what you're saying right now about how folks are tuning in and they only just want to know like what to eat. I mean, I think it's more important for you to ask yourself, you know, do I think that I'm worthy? Am I really worth it? Because if the only thing that you're thinking about is the mind controlled thought process of money, it equals, you know, access, then you really are, you're really brainwashed into hating yourself so much. And I'm using these trigger words because if you're feeling triggered, trigger is a professional term for mind, you know, when it's a psychological professional term that refers to words that upset people who have been brainwashed and are under mind control. And I don't say this lightly because I was 100% mind controlled. And I was so mind controlled that they made me believe that it was okay for me to let them put my daughter through human torture therapy. I gave them permission to treat my daughter, which was the biggest mistake of my life. I mean, it's my biggest regret if I have any regrets. And I take 100% responsibility for that foolishness. And I think that before anybody gains any health, before it matters what kind of meat or whatever it is that I put on my plate, you know, like before all of that, do you believe that you are worth everything or whatever? I mean, you have to know your worth. And I mean, I'm just here to tell you, you were born worthy beyond belief. But, you know, words can't change your mind. You have to experience that worthiness. You need to find some way to love yourself. And I think that it's my challenge for everybody out there. If you start looking at your budget for food, like I need the top of my budget to be, you know, I need my income to be bigger than the bottom of the funnel. I need the top of my funnel to be bigger than the bottom of the funnel. And then you just tell the universe, I need this, you know, I need whatever I need so that I can be satisfied. And I know that you are going to make the top of my funnel bigger than the bottom of my funnel so that I can do that. I think that if you test it, you will somehow magically have enough to just get whatever you need from the farmers. Don't hear them when they say how much it is. Don't even care. Just get what you need and just test it for 30 days. Worst case scenario, you might have a credit card bill that you got to pay off. Best case scenario is you were able to pay it off with no problem and you were satisfied. And the numbers don't make any sense to you because they're so weird and so different from what you were used to. But magically, you were able to do it and you feel better. So that's my challenge for anybody out there.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Your support means the absolute world to me. And if you're enjoying the show, I've got a small favour to ask you. I'd be incredibly grateful if you would consider becoming a supporter and make a small monthly donation. Your contribution will really help to improve the show. I'll be able to improve the software, maybe put a few more episodes out, and do many things that I'm hoping to do in the future. Do them a lot quicker. So, it's a small monthly contribution. You can cancel at any time, and the link is in the show notes. Thanks very much for listening.